Conversations from the Heart unravels big and small ideas, developments, and breakthroughs in cardiology. From vital issues such as how to prevent cardiovascular disease, to the latest in treatment and care for the millions of people affected by it, we take our listeners on an exploration journey. A journey towards stronger health systems and healthier hearts. Brought to you by the World Heart Federation and presented by Pablo Perel and Boriana Pervan, the podcast will feature conversations with practitioners, authors of key publications and discoveries, and people passionate about heart health. From our heart to yours, thank you for letting us in.
Policy makers also are influenced by policy shapers. As Martin Luther King said, change does not roll in on the wheels of inevitability. It calls for continuous struggle.
Welcome to the third edition of our Conversation from the Heart podcast series. It is the beginning of autumn here in Switzerland, and we at the World Heart Federation, together with the entire cardiovascular community, just celebrated World Heart Day, our biggest platform for awareness raising about heart health, focused heavily on prevention. It is very timely then that we now have the honor to welcome one of the global leaders in the field of cardiovascular science, Srinath Reddy, the president of the Public Health Foundation of India. Hello from us in Geneva. How are you today and where do we find you, Professor?
In India, on the suburbs of Indian capital Delhi, in a place called Gurugram.
Thank you. You are described as a leader in preventive cardiology, a researcher, teacher, policy enabler, advocate, and activist who has dedicated all his professional life to promote cardiovascular health and continues to do so. I would like to ask you which one description, which noun from this long list of nouns used to describe you would you like to single out, and why is this important to you?
Well, I think of myself as an evidence-energized change agent. I would like to see myself as a link between sound science and good public policy.
And what does really policy enabler mean in practice? It's a term that wouldn't mean a lot to many people out there. So can you tell us, how does somebody like you enable policy change?
Well, policy makers also are influenced by policy shapers. And we must recognize that policy requires many types of evidence. It requires scientific credibility based on biomedical, epidemiological, clinical, and health systems type of research. It also requires financial feasibility. So it requires health economics research. It requires operational steerability. Is a particular proposed intervention scalable, sustainable, and is it possible to deliver it? Then it also requires evidence of political viability. Are their constituencies ready to receive a particular intervention in terms of a change in policy, whether in the level of the policymakers or in the level of the health professionals or at the level of the public? So that requires social science research. So what we do is to try and collate all of these and then try and present a case to policymakers as to why a particular intervention is required, whether at the level of policy or at the level of a program. And we make a strong case for that based on all of this evidence. And that is how I believe we are actually acting as policy enablers.
Could you possibly give us an example of a policy change you had created or supported or took part in the transformation of policy in your country or elsewhere?
At least two instances I'd like to cite. One is in the area of tobacco control, where I was actively campaigning for tobacco control from the early 1980s. But I was also an active researcher, and I was also mobilizing public opinion, whether of school and college students or of communities, and networking with a number of other civil society organizations who are also interested in tobacco control. collectively we advanced that agenda in India, which was not easy because India is a major producer of tobacco and also a major exporter of tobacco. And we know that governments are often more addicted to tobacco than people themselves. So we had to make a very strong case and mobilize a very strong civil society and media opinion in favor of tobacco control. And we continued to collect evidence of what it was doing in India, whether smoked tobacco or smokeless tobacco, how advertising, direct and indirect, was actually propelling the pandemic. All of this was also based on research from India, not just borrowed knowledge from elsewhere. And ultimately, we managed to push that. And I was asked to be part of the Indian delegation which negotiated the Global Framework Convention on Tobacco Control in WHO. And as the chief technical delegate, over a period of time, I became the chief spokesperson for India, for Southeast Asia, and many of the developing countries. And we managed to get very strong provisions included in the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. I see myself as having contributed to that. Secondly, in India, we did not have universal health coverage. There was a huge financial burden on people who had to seek health care. And I was asked in 2010 by the Planning Commission of India to head a high-level expert group to prepare a framework for universal health coverage in India. That report has taken time, but has been reflected in the National Health Policy of India for 2017. And now several schemes, both at the central government level and the level of various state governments, are beginning to incorporate elements of what we recommended. It's not always easy victory which is achieved in short time, but as Martin Luther King said, change does not roll in on the wheels of inevitability. It calls for continuous struggle. And struggle we did with some success.
You did touch upon the very, very concrete examples and actions you took and what they resulted in on the level of the population. But what was maybe now on a global scale at the time of the writing of the Sustainable Development Goals, when you were also the president of the World Health Federation, what was your global mission at the time? And what was your role in helping define the Sustainable Development Goals for the entire world?
One of the key messages that we wanted to get across to people who were framing the goals is that non-communicable diseases were neglected in the Millennium Development Goals. NCDs were not mentioned. Even tobacco control was not mentioned, despite the fact that NCDs were by then already, even by 2000, by the MDG declaration time, the leading cause of death in most parts of the world. And they were killing a very large number of people in their productive midlife years in low and middle income countries. So we had to really make the case that NCDs needed to be brought in to the Sustainable Development Goals, tobacco control needed to be brought into the Sustainable Development Goals, and of course, universal health coverage needed to be brought in as well. I think our great success was in ensuring that NCDs and mental health and tobacco control were prominently incorporated into the Sustainable Development Goals.
Hi, Srinath. I'll step in to ask you a question. And moving to something that is more recent, you have chaired the writing group of the new WHO hypertension guidelines. Hypertension, it's one of the major global health problems, but it's one of the most researched conditions in clinical medicine. We have had effective treatment for decades and probably hundreds of guidelines. Do you think this new WHO guideline will make a difference? And if so, why?
I believe they will make a difference, because the burden of cardiovascular disease, stroke and myocardial infarction and coronary heart disease, and even other manifestations of hypertension in terms of chronic renal disease and widespread peripheral vascular disease, all of these are now being much more manifest in the low and middle income countries. And we are also seeing that they do not have many people who are aware of the fact that they have high blood pressure. Those who are aware are not on treatment. and those who are on treatment are not adequately controlled. There is a huge health system failure there. And much of this disease burden is eminently avertible. We can save very many valuable lives and prevent a lot of disability. And it is important that we bring in guidelines which are certainly strongly backed by science, but at the same time, feasible for implementation in low-resourced health systems. And that is the idea of getting these guidelines into place. We cannot really think of guidelines framed only for highly resourced health systems functioning in the near ideal conditions. We have to recognize the constraints in low and middle income countries and bring the best of science as far as possible into effective control of blood pressure and reduce the very many disorders that are contributing to high burden of hypertensive disease. And that's why these guidelines are very relevant. As I said, they're very strong in science, but they're also contextually adapted to low resource settings. And they offer an opportunity for more effective management of hypertension and thereby a much greater impact on the disease burden. It's very simple, Pablo, because if you really look at the goals that we have set for ourselves, whether it is reduction of 25% mortality by 2025, between 2010 and 2025 because of NCDs, or one-third reduction by 2030 of NCDs as the Sustainable Development Goals want, we must recognize that cardiovascular disease must make the most major contribution to that achievement of that goal. You're not going to get one-third reduction in cancer mortality. You're not going to get one-third reduction in respiratory disease-related mortality. Yes, we must try. But the maximum impact is going to come from reduction in cardiovascular deaths and disability. And there, hypertension is undoubtedly the leading risk factor for stroke and myocardial infarction and even for chronic renal failure. And therefore, a risk factor which is eminently and easily treatable should not suffer such neglect because of health system failures. And that's why these guidelines become very, very important.
Absolutely. And I do agree, for those listeners that haven't read the WHO guideline, I strongly recommend that. I really like the implementation remarks after each recommendation. And also, I think it's very practical. So I think well done and congratulations on that. So going back to the importance of global cardiovascular health, as you were saying, and how it's key for SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. You've been working, as you were saying to us, for decades on this, you know, from tobacco control to the very recent hypertension guidelines. So you are a champion on global cardiovascular health, without any doubt. I mean, you've seen all these decades. Which have been the main progresses in terms of global cardiovascular health? And which do you think remain the key challenges?
Firstly, there was a big challenge in terms of getting people to believe that cardiovascular diseases are very important for low and middle income countries as well. The feeling that these are so-called lifestyle disorders relevant only to affluent countries prevailed for quite some time, despite the initial global burden of disease study results in 1994, which reflected the burdens of 1990. But as you saw, Millennium Development Goals did not even bother to mention that. But what we had to do, I mean, researchers across the world, as well as advocates, was to point out, on the basis of strongly gathered evidence, that cardiovascular diseases are rising and rising rapidly in low and middle income countries, that there is also a progressive reversal of social gradient. The poor are getting much more affected, as in the Western societies, but this whole process is getting sort of telescoped very fast because of rapid industrialization and rampant urbanization, unplanned, and also the globalization, which formed the tailwind of the 20th century, really speeding up the transition in low and middle income countries. Therefore, many of these health systems were propelled into a place where they were not ready for this huge surge of cardiovascular disease. And therefore, we have to draw attention first to the magnitude of the problem, then point out that there are very effective solutions. All of them are not costly. And in fact, early interventions can actually prevent late complications which require technology-intensive and highly expensive treatments. And therefore, for example, if you treat hypertension effectively, you don't need to necessarily go in for coronary artery bypass surgery or renal transplantation if you do that well. So these are the kind of messages that we have to give, and we have given that. And I think it's absolutely important that we also provide solutions to the policymakers and not just point out the problems. So we prepared roadmaps as well when I was the president of the World Heart Federation, identifying three priority areas where we could make a huge difference in fairly short time. One was tobacco control, second is hypertension control, and third is secondary prevention. Because if you actually can prevent recurrence of cardiovascular events, then in a relatively short time frame, you can prevent a large number of deaths and much of the disability, even as you're building up a lot of preventive potential through tobacco control and hypertension control. So I think these are some of the things that have actually entered into national policy framework, and having the World Health Organization as an ally has been very, very helpful in this regard. But the challenges remain that basically people do not recognize how much of an effect things like hypertension have. Even in the COVID-19 pandemic, you saw that the vast majority of people who had severe disease or died were people with comorbidities, which were non-communicable diseases, and most often it was hypertension. So it's not just non-NCDs that matter. We know that whenever there is a respiratory virus pandemic, SARS-1, MERS, or SARS-2, or H5N1, the warning always goes out from public health authorities that people with hypertension and diabetes are at the highest risk. Then why are health systems still neglecting to detect people with these comorbidities and manage them effectively in the first place, rather than waiting for some respiratory virus to come and claim lives because hypertension has not been detected or not been treated? So I think these are the kind of lessons that we must keep bringing to the fore before the public as well as the policymakers.
Thank you. And yes, and I think I agree that COVID has also maybe bring an opportunity to raise all these issues in terms of NCDs and cardiovascular disease specifically. Of course, and we continue with the roadmaps that you started. I'm sure you're very proud that we have continued with that vision that you have. But I would like to move more to India now. I mean, you are the living example of that aphorism that says, think globally, act local. Public Health Foundation India, I mean, you show the world an example of a rigorous academic organization, but at the same time, engage with policymakers and that is impactful. So we have listeners from all around the world. And I'm thinking mainly those, maybe they are in low and income country, who like you might be passionate about improving population cardiovascular health. I know it's difficult to summarize it in a few words, but what would be the main lessons they'd like to share with them? So potentially we can have many PHFI around the world.
We must recognize that we need multidisciplinary learning for multi-sectoral implementation. Health is a complex adaptive system, and it also has multiple determinants outside of the traditional health sector. But even within the health sector, there's a fair amount of complexity within the health system. So you need to have public health institutions to bring in that multidisciplinary knowledge to support clinical excellence. And unless we bring that knowledge in terms of health system interventions, we will find even talented clinicians becoming lonely knights battling the dragons in intensive care units. On the other hand, together, people in public health as well as people in the clinical arena can make a tremendous amount of difference in order to prevent disease, to detect disease early, treat it effectively, cost-effectively, and prevent much of the disability. And how do we create efficient and equitable and empathetic systems which can deliver this range of services? That's why we need public health institutions as well. not only for the epidemiological research, which tells us what the problem diagnostic is, but also effective interventions, which are both, in a sense, therapeutic or diagnostic, but also social interventions. So I think having the Public Health Foundation of India helped, and we do have a lot of clinician researchers with us. It's not as though we are only fixing water pipes. We are, water pipes was where it started in Broad Street, water pumps rather. But we are actually looking at multiple clinical problems as well. But we are looking at it from the system angle. How do we improve the systems so that clinical recognition and management can become better? And we work with social scientists, we work with health technologists, and we work with health economists. And bringing all of that knowledge together helps in finding a viable and sustainable solution.
I mean, as always, very clear, very inspiring listening to you, Srinath. I would like to finish with, you already, I think, shared a lot of lessons and in a way, I think, take home messages. But we always like to give the opportunity to our guests to talk to the whole WHF community specifically. So you have the audience of people like you, passionate about global health. And what would be your message, in particular, what do you think should be WHF priorities, let's say, for the next 10 years?
I have been proud to be a cardiologist, and I was greatly honored to have been the president of the World Heart Federation for 2 years between 2013 and 15. I believe cardiologists can be a great force for change in the health sector and even in other sectors. I have been the first Bernard Blount visiting professor of cardiovascular health at Harvard, a position that was created by late Dr. Bernard Blount, who not only invented the cardiac defibrillator, but also won the Nobel Peace Prize. He also started the PROCOR and Satellite in order to bring in medical education and public health education to people across the world. So there are a number of role models in the area of cardiology to inspire us. But collectively, we can be a very strong force for desirable social change to improve our health systems, improve public health, and to advance the goals of sustainable development. And for that, we need to network, not only among ourselves, but to build very cordial coalitions with a number of other organizations with convergent aspirations and objectives, whether it is the environmentalists, the people in food security who are looking at healthy and adequate nutrition, or people who are looking at urban design and transport and looking at how physical activity can be fostered along with traffic safety. We need to join hands. And the larger the coalitions we can build, even while we are practicing excellence in our own domain, chosen domain of cardiology, we can actually become very successful in advancing the agenda of social change. And I believe cardiologists can do it.
Very inspiring. One last question from me, Professor. How did you get inspired to become the leader and the change maker that you are today? I don't imagine it's just one day you wake up with, the desire to become a change maker. Is there a story? Is there a person behind your decision and your path towards becoming a change maker?
I must, I suppose, credit my father, not very directly, but he was a voracious reader. The house was full of books. And I, as the only child, could actually spend a lot of time going through the books, all of which I may not have understood. But I was introduced to a number of things. I was introduced to the life story of Norman Bethune, the Canadian surgeon who went and fought in the Spanish Revolutionary War. And, he did a lot of good things. And he was a person who actually asked for universal health coverage as well. I was inspired later on in my medical college years by Rudolf Virchow, who was an eminent pathologist, but also the founder of the Anthropological Society of Germany, and who really founded the whole area of social epidemiology. So there have been many people who have inspired me, and I realized that we must try and provide as much good care as possible to the patient who comes to us. And that's the duty of the doctor, to heal as many people as possible to relieve as many people as possible and certainly to comfort all. But at the same time, you have to address the health problems of the society in a broader plane. Otherwise, you'll continue to have rising tides of ill patients, and even the best of medical systems cannot cope with that. So in order to apply correctives, you have to also bring in public health, you have to bring in also other sectors of society in order to try and reduce the conditions that create disease and foster conditions that create good health. So this sort of became apparent to me even as a practicing clinician.
Thank you so much. That was truly inspiring, and I'm sure you are an inspiration to many, many, many leading cardiologists and healthcare practitioners of today. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Most welcome. Always delighted to be part of any event organized by World Heart Federation.
You're part of the family, for sure.
Thank you very much, Trina.
Dear Conversations from the Heart listeners, if you want to listen to more engaging conversations with leaders in civil society, policymaking, and academia, don't forget to tune in for the World Heart Summit, starting 14th of October and running through 19th of November. This year, the summit calls on the cardiology community and its allies to act on obesity. It will be co-chaired by one past guest of the podcast, Professor Liesl Zülke, and headlined by another, Professor Salim Yusuf. The summit is your source of information, debate, and policymaking about the future of cardiovascular health. To subscribe to see all the events, go to worldheartfederation.org/events. Please join us.
From our heart to yours, thank you for letting us in, and goodbye.